Is it Ms. Hartner?
Yes, Your Honor.
Good morning to you. And Ms. Osborne, good morning to you. Do either of you have any questions before we begin?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Hartner, I apologize if I mispronounced the name of your client.
Kaniwa.
Kaniwa.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Chelsea Hartner, attorney for the appellant, Nathaniel Kaniwa. This is an appeal from the Madison County District Court. Mr. Kaniwa, on October 24th of 2022, entered a plea of guilty to operating a motor vehicle to avoid arrest, willful reckless, a class 4 felony. The court ordered a pre-sentence investigation and set sentencing for a later date. On December 20th, 2022, Kaniwa filed a motion for deferred judgment pursuant to Nebraska Revised Statute Section 29-2292. On December 21st, at his sentencing hearing, the lower court heard the motion for deferred judgment and overruled that, finding that the statute was unconstitutional because without a judgment of conviction or sentence, the court believed it did not have jurisdiction to place a person on probation.
Did anyone ask the court to find the statute unconstitutional?
I believe the county attorney did make a brief argument objecting to the deferred judgment based upon a separation of powers, but didn't really go any further than that. No.
So,
yes. Yeah.
But it wasn't very lengthy.
Okay.
The lower court did find Kaniwa was a candidate for probation, however, and he was sentenced to a term of probation for a period of 18 months. Kaniwa appeals the denial of his motion for deferred judgment. Kaniwa asserts that the trial court erred in its finding that the statute was unconstitutional. Statutes are presumed to be constitutional, and all reasonable doubts will be resolved in favor of constitutionality, and further, that penal statutes must be construed so as to meet constitutional requirements if such can be reasonably done. Here, Kaniwa argues that the lower court still retains jurisdiction to impose a term of probation, even if a sentence hasn't been imposed.
Is probation a sentence?
Probation has previously been held to be a sentence, and in that case, they referred to the term statute for the probation administrative statutes. However, that statute has since been amended with the creation of the deferred judgment statute, and so that probation, while it is a sentence or a term of post-release supervision, it also includes a term of supervision under the deferred judgment statute. The court is able to already impose probation-like conditions without a conviction, without even finding a guilt. One way they're able to do this already is through a part of a defendant's bond. I think 29-901 allows the court to impose nearly identical probation-like terms, testing, reporting, getting evaluations, monitoring, classes. They have pretrial diversion programs in some areas that are permitted, where they would have to report to an entity that is designated. And these are very similar, if not identical, to probation conditions in that are found in 29-2262, and just the reporting to an officer, also very similar. Courts can also, following a finding of guilt, require substance abuse or mental health evaluations pursuant to the pre-sentence investigation statute, and can also commit a person to the Department of Corrections for further evaluations, all prior to sentencing.
Let's assume that we agree with you. You're advocating that the statute is not unconstitutional. Right?
Yes.
Let's assume we agree with you. How does that affect the disposition? The court did impose, I take it, a sentence of some kind.
The court sentenced him to a term of probation. How would it affect him? We would ask to vacate the sentence and judgment and send it back down to the lower court.
Okay.
So for consideration of a possible deferred judgment?
The court found he was a candidate for probation, but didn't look into whether or not he was a candidate for deferred judgment. It just stopped after he found the statute to be unconstitutional. So, yes, we would probably need to go back and determine whether or not, if in addition to being a probation candidate, he's also a deferred judgment candidate.
So, if that's where we are procedurally, and given that you may not have time after the state talks. Do you want to talk about constitutionality?
Yes. I think the main point on the judge's ruling is that I think he's wrong, that I think when they changed the statute, but I also don't think that the statute violates the separation of powers clause. The legislature has plenary authority to define crimes and punishments, the nature of the penalty imposed, and what is the public policy in the state. And by doing that, they are setting the broad public policy goals in Nebraska's criminal justice system. It's previously been held that the legislature has the ability to create a pretrial diversion program, and in that case, the court found that it was not an outgrowth of the charging function held by the executive, but rather a substantial change in the way that society responds to the challenge of crime. And this type of broad restructuring is something that is the responsibility of the legislative branch. It has to do with public policy rather than just charging. And so I think similar to in that case, by creating the deferred judgment statute, the legislature is setting a broad public policy goal of rehabilitation in this state. And by creating a way for a person to do this programming, do this probation, and then possibly not be a felon at the end of the day. And
as,
so,
as I understand the state's argument, their objection is that this allows the court to dismiss charges, and that that's the dismissal of charges is a unique prosecutorial and executive function. How do you respond to that?
Well, I don't think that the disposal of a case is something that is unique to just the executive branch. The legislature has created many ways in which a case can be disposed of or dismissed without a conviction, and it's laid out in statute. After a preliminary hearing, if there's not probable cause, a plea and abatement, motion to quash, plea and bar, things of that nature that are created by statute by the legislature, and the court has the autonomy to make that decision and dismiss it or discharge of the case in that fashion. And
but
so,
aren't all of those instances determinations of the validity of a charge, not the determination of whether or not the charge should exist?
I would agree with that, but I would also say that once that guilt has been established, at that point, like, the charging discretion is complete, and what we're left is with sentencing discretion. And I referred to a case out of Nevada in my brief where they had a similar issue and basically found that because guilt has been established, that at that point, that what we have is sentencing discretion. And so since if that's the case, then what the deferred judgment statute is now a sentencing statute, which falls within the purview of the judiciary. And so it's a public policy thing created by the legislature. And so I think that at that point, I think it belongs to the judiciary and not to the executive at that point.
Are
and
you,
I think that's
are
the
you
difference.
Characterizing there's a finding of guilt? The case is in front of the trial court, and are you saying it's a mere one of the choices upon sentencing?
Yes.
When did the finding of guilt occur?
In this case, it was on October 24th when he entered a plea of guilty.
And that gets to the state's argument about timing.
Yes.
So do you want to respond to that?
I don't think the statute has any timing other than before a judgment of conviction or sentence is entered. And so that would...
It says upon a finding of guilt, a defendant may request. What's the meaning of upon?
At or after? I mean, I would argue unless the statute is specifically says you must file this on this date. I mean, I think that's broad enough to include up until the time of sentencing. The judgment of conviction and sentence happens at sentencing, so it up until that point, it can be deferred. So I would think that the request would be available up until that point.
The statute gives then some procedure for the state to be heard the defendant to be heard for the court to consider the request. Is that accurate?
Yes, the statute provides for a hearing and the opportunity to be heard. I think at that point, the state would have the ability to list their objections. The court would be able to take that into consideration and then would use its discretion to decide what the appropriate sentence would be, whether that to be to defer and place on deferred judgment, or if not, to sentence them pursuant to the crime that they've been convicted of.
How is this not the court's act exercising clemency?
Well, that would require a conviction. We haven't got that far yet. So we're asking to not be convicted, and I would say that's how it's different. There's no other questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Osborne, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Jordan Osborne, Assistant Attorney General on behalf of the state of Nebraska. Nebraska's deferred judgment statute was drafted in such a way that it violates our separation of powers clause in our Nebraska state constitution because it permits the judiciary to encroach upon the executive function. Inherent within the executive function is prosecutorial discretion, which includes the authority over the initiation of charges, the pursuit of charges, and the discretion to dismiss or reduce charges that have already been filed. In the deferred judgment statute that we're addressing here today, the legislature has granted the judiciary the authority to dismiss charges entirely over the prosecution's objection. And we're not talking about charges.
Doesn't the statute just give the prosecutor the opportunity to object, and the court then can decide?
That's exactly what it does.
So how does that take any authority away? Or how does that violate separation of powers?
Because the charges can be dismissed over the prosecutor's objection. We're not talking about charges that have a legal defect or that there was a failure to meet the burden of proof. The statute specifically provides for the dismissal of valid charges that have already been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And
over objection.
Over the prosecutor's objection.
Had the statute, assuming the validity of your position, which I'm not saying, but assuming that, if the statute had said, unless the prosecutor objects, in other words, if the prosecutor had a veto built into that statute, would it pass constitutional muster?
If the prosecutor, if the charges are dismissed or deferred judgments granted, which can result in the dismissal of charges, occurs at the consent of the prosecutor, there's no constitutional issue here.
Should we read the statute that way to avoid potential constitutional problem?
If it's possible to do so.
I guess I'm asking you.
My reading of it, without actually changing the language of the statute, I don't really see how you could infer that prosecutorial consent in there, because all the statute provides is the prosecutor to comment. It gives the prosecutor an opportunity to object, but it allows the court to dismiss the charges over that objection.
So, I beg your pardon, so there is an application of the statute that is constitutional?
Yes, that if the prosecutor consents to the deferred judgment, to dismissal of charges, there's not a constitutional issue in that situation. That's not
as
what happened here.
As applied to those facts.
As applied to that situation, yes.
So, how do you respond to the concept that statutes are given the presumption of constitutionality, particularly in the criminal context, and also that it's the Attorney General's job to defend the constitutionality of statutes?
Well, obviously we're sort of on the opposite side of where we usually are. And it is true that the presumption is for constitutionality. But what has happened here is essentially this amounts to an unjustified judicial interference in the prosecutorial function of the executive branch and the legislature.
Isn't that a pretty vague argument? There's nothing in the Constitution that says that the executive branch should have some veto over a court sentencing.
Well, this, I would disagree with that characterization. This is not a veto over a sentence. In fact, this issue turns on whether deferred judgment is a sentence or a sentencing alternative. And our argument here is that it's neither. This is not a sentence that's being imposed.
But it's our job, seems to me, the statutory is presumption that this is constitutional. And if indeed we can construe this as a sentence or a sentence alternative, that would make the statute constitutional, correct?
Well, it would, but you would have to find that this is a that deferred judgment is essentially a sentence or a sentencing alternative. And that's what this argument turns on. It is not a sentence, and it is not a sentencing alternative. So if you look at the actual language of the statute, it says that the court may defer the entry of judgment and imposition of sentence. So we're not imposing a sentence at all. We're deferring it. The plain meaning of the word defer is to postpone to a later time. If you're delaying a sentence is not being imposed. Another reason this is not a sentence is that defendants can reject deferred judgment, but they can't reject a sentence. If deferred judgment was truly a sentence, the defendant has no power to reject it. The appellant cites to a divided Nevada court opinion, but I would direct the court's attention to the dissenting opinion in that case. The majority concluded that the defendant's placement into a veterans court was a sentencing decision, but the dissent points out the flaw in that reasoning. The dissent stated this is a false analogy. An assignment to veterans court is not analogous to sentencing. The assignment defers sentencing, and the successful completion of veterans court results in the dismissal of charges. The Kentucky Supreme Court provided the same reasoning when it interpreted the constitutionality of a similar statute. Just like the appellant's argument here, the defendant in Kentucky argued that his placement into a diversion program after he entered a guilty plea and over the prosecutor's objection was a sentencing alternative akin to a sentence of probation. The Kentucky Supreme Court rejected that argument. They stated that the diversion program could not be characterized as simply a sentencing alternative available to the trial court for consideration. It found the most significant distinguishing feature is that unlike a sentence of imprisonment, probation, or conditional discharge, the admission into a diversion program permits a defendant who successfully completes that diversion to avoid a felony conviction entirely, and that's because there's going to be a complete dismissal of the charges. The court stated this was an interruption of prosecution prior to final disposition, which requires the prosecutor's agreement. And that's exactly what we have with this statute.
And all of these programs to which you're referring in these other states, these are all post-plea?
Yes.
Okay. Which has been the approach in this state?
That's
the alternative courts.
Right. That's how the statutory framework for deferred judgment is set up. It's post-plea.
Another statutory framework that's set up is the problem-solving courts. Is the distinction between this and the problem-solving courts the willing participation of the prosecutor?
Yes. That and it's also the distinction between our pretrial diversion as well. The prosecutor consents to diversion and problem-solving court participation. The prosecutor's consent is not required in deferred judgment. That's what makes, that's the difference between them.
Regardless of constitutionality, was this timely filed?
Our position is that no, it was not. And that turns on the meaning of the phrase entry of judgment of conviction. So Nebraska appellate courts have referred to a judgment of conviction as a finding of guilt, and that's separate and distinct from accepting a guilty plea. So if you put those together, at a plea hearing, what you have is the court accepts a guilty plea, the court enters a judgment of conviction by finding the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, and then they enter that judgment of conviction in an order or journal entry, which
can be referred to as rendition. The plain language of 2922-92 supports this because it talks about deferring the entry of judgment of conviction and the imposition of sentence. If those two things were synonyms, then you would have a statute that is repetitive and superfluous, which is to be avoided in statutory interpretation. Nebraska appellate courts have also said that to create finality in a criminal case, it's necessary that there be a judgment of conviction followed by a sentence. That further indicates that these are two distinct things.
So in this context, your position is that the defendant would have had to move or ask for a deferred judgment at the same hearing at which he entered his plea? You said it depends on the meaning of finding of guilt for which a judgment of conviction may be rendered, but also depends a little bit on the meaning of the word upon, doesn't it? I mean, upon mean same day, shortly thereafter, anytime thereafter?
The statute says upon a finding of guilt for which a judgment of conviction may be rendered. The rendering is the rendition. It's the entry of the written order, the journal entry of the finding of guilt,
which happens at the plea hearing in this case, correct?
The finding of guilt happens at the plea hearing, and then you have a journal entry that will come after that. So the request for deferred judgment has to happen before that journal entry, that rendition, is filed with the court, which didn't happen in this case. In this case, the journal entry was filed the same day as the plea hearing, which you can find in the transcript at pages 44 and 45. That was 2 months, almost a full 2 months before the defendant requested deferred judgment.
So in most instances, well, let's assume a jury context, you have a finding, jury comes back and says, find the defendant guilty, and the trial court would then reduce that verdict to a written determination that the verdict had been rendered, and typically that occurs the same day as the entry, as the return of the verdict of the jury. So you're really saying the statute has in most instances, an extremely narrow window of the hearing at which this occurs.
A couple of responses to that. First, if in a plea context, I'm not saying that the request can't be made prior to the plea hearing. Certainly you can file a request for deferred judgment, or I anticipate requesting deferred judgment prior to the plea hearing. You can do it orally at the plea hearing.
So upon now means before?
Well, I think that the upon is when the court is going to take it up. Upon the finding of guilt, upon the finding of guilt for which a judgment of conviction may be rendered. So if somebody has filed a request prior to the plea hearing, then that's when it becomes an issue for the court to take up, is upon the finding of guilt.
An inchoate filing until they enter their plea of guilty, and then it springs to life?
You want to file a written request, essentially I think you would have to do it before you go into the plea hearing. Otherwise, you're just going to make an oral request. And as for the jury...
Or come to the hearing with a written request in your hand.
You could. You could file it, I guess, in the middle of the hearing. You could leave the courtroom, or you could do it at the end of the hearing. But the jury example that you gave, I think it's very questionable whether this statute even applies to people who go to trial. It's not very clear. The statute is poorly written. The first section talks about upon a finding of guilt, so that doesn't really indicate whether it's a plea or whether it's a trial. But then in subsection 6, which is the dismissal section, they talk about filing a motion to withdraw a plea. I don't know why you would do that. I don't know how you would go through the process of withdrawing your plea if you went to trial.
What do you think the legislature intended here?
I'm not sure what the legislature intended. It's very difficult to tell because it's so poorly written.
In subsection 6, it doesn't say the plea, it says any plea. Doesn't that mean that perhaps there wasn't a plea?
Well, if your plea is no contest, or if your plea is not guilty, I'm not sure why you're withdrawing it. The process of withdrawing your plea for the purpose of having your charges dismissed would apply to a plea of guilty or no contest. And of course, the legislature promoted this as, I guess, sort of quoting from what one of the senators said, is this is a poor man's problem-solving court that involves plea-based findings of guilt. So somebody comes in going into drug court, for example, you plead guilty. So I think the statutory framework is intended to apply to plea-based situations, not trials. And unless there are further questions, I think I'm out of time. I would ask this court to affirm the judgment of the district court and find 2292 unconstitutional. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? No, there is no time for rebuttal. Counsel, you are, that concludes arguments and you are excused. And the court will go on to the next case of the day, which is Lopez versus Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of Omaha.